Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm pleased to have as my guest today Ian Rankin, and we would be discussing Mr. Rankin's novel Blood Hunt, currently published by Little Brown. And Ian, if you would, tell us a bit about the Jack Harvey books that you wrote, Blood Hunt being the second one published in the U.S., Witch Hunt was published in 2004 and is available in paperback. And these were three books that you wrote back in the 1990s, correct?
Yeah, I wrote them because I was desperate for some money. This was at a time when the Inspector Rebus books weren't doing much business in the UK, and also they weren't quite as long and complex as they are now. So they were only taking me a few weeks to write each of the Rebus books, and that left a lot of free time. And my publisher at that time didn't want another Rebus novel in the same year. So I went to a different publisher and pitched the idea to them of doing some mainstream thrillers, not crime novels necessarily, not set in Edinburgh, a bit more wide-ranging and aimed at a slightly different audience. And they said, sure, but let's do them under a pseudonym, Jack Harvey, so that people don't buy them thinking they're getting an Inspector Rebus novel.
Okay. And let's talk for a minute just first about Witch Hunt, which was the first one published here in the U.S. And I really enjoyed Witch Hunt. It has a female assassin, very different structurally from the Rebus novels, and I really like what you did with the female character because you can change the way they look, the way they act, and I found myself when I picked that up reading it, I couldn't put it down. It's a very compelling storyline, and writing from the female assassin point of view, it seemed to me like you were having fun when you were doing that.
Yeah, writing all three of those Jack Harvey novels was fun because it was such a different mindset from writing about a glum, middle-aged Edinburgh detective with a smoking and drinking problem. I could jump into a lot of different skins. And I seem to remember that my female assassin was lifted pretty much from a figure in comic books at the time, Elektra. Elektra was a villainess in the Daredevil comics, and then a comic book writer called Frank Miller, who's also responsible, of course, for Sin City. Mm-hmm. I think he did a standalone graphic novel with her, and I just thought she was such a great character that I thought, you know, let's make her that bit more three-dimensional and use that template for this very... a very English assassin. I mean, at the end of the book, although everything seems to be about a huge... international conspiracy and she's trying to get to the bottom of it, it all becomes very personal towards the end. And so the book starts off being very international and then it gets more and more localized as you get towards the conclusion and the revelation of why she's doing the job that she's doing.
Mm-hmm. So now let's move on to Blood Hunt, which Little Brown has just published here. And George Reeve, who I believe was in the first Rebus novel, was he not, Ian?
What I did was, I having published a few Rebus novels, I went back to the very first one, Knots and Crosses, which I'd written when I was a student, and I felt that the bad guy in that book, the villain of the piece, my Mr. Hyde to Inspector Rebus's Dr. Jekyll, I felt I'd given him a really rough time, you know. In fact, at the end of the book, he's dead. And I thought, you know, he was an interesting character in a lot of ways. I liked his background. So what I did was I just revivified him. I brought him back to life. I brought him back from the grave and gave him exactly the same name and background and everything else. But at a point in his life at which, in the Rebus novels, he meets Rebus.
In Blood Hunt, Ian, George Reeves' brother Jim is a journalist, and he's working on a story about a chemical company, Co World Chemical, in San Diego. And the police have told Gordon that it's a suicide, but Gordon doesn't believe it. And he's running this survivalist camp, and he decides he's going to investigate on his own. And that's where things get very interesting when he starts coming over to the U.S.
Yeah, I this was a, I mean, it's a chase novel in a lot of ways, and there is a large conspiracy attached to it, which actually was something that was really current at the time when I wrote the book, which was, you know, what is behind mad cow disease, a problem that we had in the UK that was huge at that time. Lots of, all the cattle was being destroyed, basically, huge furnaces everywhere in the countryside. It was horrible. And there were various theories as to what was behind mad cow disease, and there was one farmer in particular who had a theory that it was down to organophosphates. And that farmer actually started to get death threats from mysterious organisations, and people who were trying to help him out, lawyers and such like, were finding the brakes tampered with their cars, etc., etc. So I thought, what a great idea for a story. But because I was writing a thriller as opposed to a crime novel, it meant that I could span the globe. And so I was able to get my character over to the States. And by this stage in my life, I'd actually been to the States a few times on tour. So I felt I knew the place a little bit. And I was able to retrace the steps of my various tours, taking my character Gordon Reeves to places I'd been.
Mm-hmm. And when Gordon gets to San Diego, he finds out that that James, he appears to be an alcoholic. He's also a very good journalist, which is a dangerous combination. and not uncommon.
It's almost a cliche because it's true.
Yes. And so
yeah, he gets to San Diego, which is, again, a place I've been on tour with previous books. I mean, there's a computer game linked into all of this. Because I was having fun at the time. I was playing a lot of computer games and trying to unlock the codes. Because, you know, you don't often realize that when you buy almost any electronic product, whether it's a DVD or a game, there's little jokes and little things hidden inside there that the developer has put in there for fun. And so I decided I'm going to have a computer game that will have a little electronic secret inside for my non-games playing hero to try and find.
Okay. And one of the things that Gordon finds out is that the police tell him that that Jim had killed himself with a gun. And Gordon knows that Jim was anti-conflict, anti-military. And that really is what tips him off, that he does not believe that this was a suicide, and leads him further into the investigation.
Yeah, because Reeve, spent many years in the military in the UK. He was in the SAS, the elite branch of the armed forces. And he knows his brother, and he knows that, well, Reeve himself might choose to commit suicide with a handgun, his brother wouldn't. I think that goes for most of us, you know. People who've been in the armed forces, if they want to commit suicide, do usually use a weapon of some kind. Most of us who are non-military would never think of that. We would use something much less gory and showy. We would take some pills and check into a motel for the night. So, I mean, that's the first... It's because he knows his brother, because he knows the inside of his skin, that he realizes that something is very wrong.
Yeah. And one of the things I liked, Ian, about both Witch Hunt and Blood Hunt is... there's a nice attention to detail that I like in this type of a novel. For example, there's a scene where Gordon folds the map up in a cab so that when they find it, they won't know where he was going, what street he was looking for. And as I live my life, sometimes I remember referring back to novels I've read, and I'll do something like that. And it kind of gives you kind of an insider's look into how some of these things work. And I think that's one of the things I liked about the two novels I've read in the series so far, is there's a very nice attention to detail.
Well, that particular instance is taken basically from the SAS survival book. If you talk to anybody who's been in the Special Air Squadron, when they're dropped behind enemy lines, as happened in Iraq, in both the conflicts in Iraq, this is basic training for them. You know, even if you're going to the toilet, you put it in a plastic bag and take it away with you. You leave no trace evidence at all. And just in case you are captured, you have done that. You folded your map in such a way that it actually misleads the captor as to what your destination has been, or where you've just been, or where your fellow soldiers might be. One of the real thrills and challenges for me, because I'm not that kind of person. I don't think I am paranoid. I've certainly got no special forces training. the challenge for me and the fun was trying to get inside the head of a person like that and say, and look at the world around and say, how do they see the world? Because they're looking for things that I'm not looking for, and they are seeing things that I'm not going to see.
And in the Rebus novels, one of the things that that your readers love is there's a lot of musical references in the Rebus, and in the three books in the Jack Harvey, I picked up a Dark Side of the Moon reference in Blood Hunt, but there's not as much of a focus on music as being a part of the plot, and I guess that's probably more germane to the genre you were writing in when you wrote the books.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the thriller has different has a different readership, a different core audience to the crime novel, and that audience are looking for a lot of technical detail. In a police novel, in a detective novel, if someone comes through the door with a gun, it can just be a gun. If someone comes through the door with a gun in a thriller, you have to have specific detailed knowledge of what kind of gun that is.
Right.
And it's the sort of thing that someone like Tom Clancy does so well because he knows his readers love it. You get pages and pages of very close analytical description of how to build a nuclear device, for example.
Right.
And when I was a kid, I grew up on thriller writers like Alistair MacLean and Frederick Forsyth. And I really did like that detail. I like the detail of how you can conceal a gun inside a crutch, for example. If you were, you know, there's a lot of fun to be had in dreaming up ways that an assassin or a secret agent or a special op person can actually go about their business. And it is escapism. There is an element of escape in it because what you're saying to the reader is put yourself in these shoes that you will never have to wear in real life. And just go away and have a blast.
Yeah.
Have some fun and be the James Bond character. Be the hero for a change.
Exactly. And Nietzsche's will to power is a very important part of Blood Hunt. And is that very pervasive in the SAS, Ian? Is that where the references in the book to Nietzsche, is that primarily where that comes from?
Most people who work in the SAS and in Special Forces, the Marines or whatever, they're not quite as intellectually minded in the whole. They tend to be action people. They like sports. They like adventure. They don't sit dipping into philosophy, especially arcane German philosophy. But there was one guy I'd met in a city in Scotland while I was on tour, and he had been in the SAS and had left. And he really was a thinker. He was a very quiet, very thoughtful guy who had read a lot of philosophies, Eastern as well as Western. And when I started to think about the character, the kind of person who would be running an outdoor centre, the fact that they're up against nature all the time, nature is trying to defeat them. They're trying to hide from the enemy in very rough terrain. They're trying to hide for days and weeks on end. And, you know, you have to look into yourself, and you've got to be very strong psychologically to do that. And I did think about Nietzsche, the philosopher, and I thought, I mean, A, there's the great pun of being one of Nietzsche's gentlemen, being one of nature's gentlemen.
Yes.
But B, there, you know, all this stuff that Nietzsche goes into about trying to live in a world without God or without any notion of a God, and staring into the abyss, staring into the nothingness of life. I just thought, you know, that's the way my guy would think. He would think along similar lines, and he would learn lessons from that philosophy. And so it ticked a box. It just seemed to me it was the right thing for him to do.
Mm-hmm. And then I also, I'm referring to the U.S. hardcover edition here. On page 236, you have Durhart ask Reeve if he'd ever read Jim Crumley before. And I was so happy to have you put that in there, because I think James Crumley is one of the finest writers who isn't as well known as he should be. And so I was just tickled when I saw that in the book.
Yeah, well, you know, there's no point in writing books if you don't turn people on, or attempt to turn people onto music that you like and other writers that you like and movies that you like and everything else. It's part of the fun for me. And I'm sure I was on a big Crumley kick when I wrote that piece.
Yeah.
Because I discovered him fairly late on. There was I think three of his books were put into one of these three-in-one packages. Because I wrote that book when I was living in France. I mean, I wasn't living in the UK. I was living in the middle of nowhere, where I did feel very isolated. I couldn't speak the language. I just sat in a little run-down, dilapidated farmhouse in the middle of nowhere writing these books. And getting care packages from home, which would have things like James Crumley novels in them, mm-hmm. Alongside sort of, you know, instant coffee and stuff that you couldn't find in France.
Yeah.
And so, I was feeling a little bit like one of these isolated characters myself. And, it was great to give Crumley a mention. And I then, later on, got to meet the man himself, and he lived up to expectation. Unlike many writers, you know, sometimes you meet your heroes and you're a little bit disappointed, but he was not a disappointment at all.
Yeah, and for the listeners, if you've never read The Last Good Kiss, you should go out and buy it and read it, because I think it's one of the finest novels written in our generation. It's just breathtaking. But moving on from Crumley, I was real fascinated in Blood Hunt. There's a drug, and I might mispronounce it, Burundanga?
Yeah.
And that plays...
You're going to ask me if it's made up, right?
I'm sorry?
You're going to ask me if it's made up.
No, I'm not. I'm just going to ask I found it fascinating, the effect, and I hope nobody ever gives it to me, because I wouldn't want my wife to know some of the things I might say. So,
It's based, even off the top of my head, it's a few years since I wrote that book, and I can't remember if it's real or not. It doesn't sound to me like I made it up. It sounds to me like it is real. And I've got a feeling that probably when I was doing the research for the book, I came across it as a truth drug that would have been administered by black ops agents around the world. There are lots of drugs like that. I mean, just recently in the UK, there was a case where people in nightclubs their drinks were being spiked, it spiked with a drug that meant that they became very submissive. So if you took them outside and said, look, just go to that ATM and take out all the cash you possibly can and give it to me, that's exactly what they would do.
Okay.
That's what I wanted from the drug. Whether it's invented or not, there are drugs like that out there that will make you very submissive and mean that people can empty your bank account, or they'll ask you questions and you will answer. I mean, it's the old classic truth theorem, the sort of thing that's been given to spies like James Bond ever since the spy novel started.
Exactly. And in Blood Hunt Part 9, the reader discovers some of the key elements of what's going on here, and it's interesting time wise, Ian, that when you wrote the book and it deals with herbicides and pesticides and genetic engineering, that now here we are in 2006 and it's become a very hot topic again. And when you originally wrote the book, it probably wasn't getting quite as much attention, was it?
No, the whole organophosphate scandal in the UK was pretty much hushed up because it's a multi-million dollar industry. The whole, trying to get farmers to use certain pesticides and trying to get farmers in poor countries, hot countries, to use certain chemicals on their crops to give them to use genetic engineering to give them a kind of crop that's going to grow. This is such a huge industry with such vast potential that's as yet untapped, that there's an awful lot to play for, there's an awful lot at stake, and whenever you've got a lot at stake, you've got people who will try to protect that stake. So to me it was a no-brainer. I thought, this is a kind of conspiracy that actually is, has the potential to exist. I mean, that's what I've always done in my books, is write about potentials, not things that are actually happening, but things, what if this happened? What if we just take that one stage further? What if this kind of conspiracy was happening right now in this country and not halfway across the world? So it was out there, it was real, and it was something that, with the exception of a couple of honourable teetotal journalists, nobody was really covering this whole affair, and so I thought, well, do it in fiction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ian, this is the second in the three Jack Harveys. I understand the third will be published this fall. Is that correct?
Yeah, Bleeding Hearts is the third one. Now that was a lot of fun as well, I have to tell you. There are two distinct narratives. One is a third-person narrative from the point of view of a private eye who's hunting down an assassin. the first-person narrative is the assassin himself. Because it's the first person, the reader cannot help but start to empathize with the bad guy, as it were, with the assassin, because you're inside his head in a way that you're not with the cop who's trying to find him. And the challenge for me there was to try and get the reader onto the side of the killer rather than the side of the forces of law and order. And from the feedback I had at the time when it was published in the UK, I think it works pretty well.
Well, yeah, and I...
it's also another extended homage, because the character of the Private Eye is a gargantuan slob. He dresses very badly. He's a sexual deviant. He's got this colossal appetite for fast food and booze and drugs. And he's kind of based on a character called John Self, who was created many years ago by the novelist Martin Amis in his novel Money. And I was so seduced by the voice of John Self that I had to recreate him in fiction myself to purge him from my system.
So, Ian, our the Jack Harvey novels, now this will be, when Bleeding Heart comes out, that will be the third. It must feel good to have them available now in the U.S. in hardcover. And is there, in the back of your mind, do you ever think I might do another one, or has Rebus just become so complex and so compelling and so demanding that these will probably be the three that that you'll write?
No, I mean, the good news about the reissue of the, because they were out of print in the UK for a long time as well, and then they were reissued quite recently, and readers fell on them and liked them and wrote to me to let me know they liked them. And that gives me hope for the future, because John Rebus, as much as I love the character, only has two more books left to go before he is forced into retirement. He hits 60, and at 60 in Scotland you retire as a cop. And so unless they change the law, to keep the series realistic, I am going to retire them. There's a book I'm writing just now, I'm about two-thirds of the way through it, and then there's one more after that, and then that'll be him. So the hope for the future for me is that readers do seem to like the other kinds of books that I write. And so while I wouldn't necessarily write under the name Jack Harvey, because I think audiences aren't that stupid, readers aren't that stupid, they'll look at the fly leaf or the back cover, they'll see it's not a Rebus novel.
Right.
They want to buy it, they'll buy it. So under my own name, I can see me writing more thrillers in the future.
Okay,
certainly
good.
Non-Rebus books. That's going to have to be what I write, because I'm only going to be 47 when I finish the Rebus series, and I hope that's not me on the scrap heap.
I understand. I remember last March when we talked, I remember you mentioning that that fact that there were two more Rebuses left. And what I'd like to tell the listeners is that when I first read Blood Hunt, there, I think there's kind of a natural inclination on the part of readers sometimes when you read something that was written prior to the author's success, that you're afraid that, that something that is going to be not going to hold up to the author's standards. And in this case, that is not the fact. I enjoyed Witch Hunt and Blood Hunt very, very much. Very glad that I read them. Could not put them down. So anybody who has that kind of...
I appreciate that. I know what you mean, because I'm one of these people who, if you like an author, you do go back and read their early stuff, and sometimes you do get you do get disappointed by those non-series books.
Yeah, and that's not the case here at all. And I'm just delighted that they're coming out here in the U.S. and being reissued in the U.K. So you're about two-thirds through with the next Rebus?
Yeah, it's sitting in front of me as we talk. I mean, here I am in Edinburgh talking to you down the line. I'm reading what I've written so far, and my wife has numbered the pages for me. I'm on page 148 of my read-through. The book itself is up to page 250, 260, 270. She's not numbered all the pages yet, so I don't really know. It's about 70 pages away from being finished. And I'm reading through it just to see what I've missed out, because I don't plan as I write. The first draft is a kind of brisk run-through of the plot, and then once I know the plot, the mechanics of the plot work, I then go back in the second draft and actually beef up the characterization, make the characters interesting, give them roles to play that are thematically relevant. The book set during the G8 meeting, which took place in Scotland last July, and Edinburgh was just crazy for a solid week. It was crazy. We had 250,000 people demonstrating through the streets. We had riots. We had the place full of cops from all over the UK. We had stars, Hollywood stars, music stars like Bono dropping in to talk to the media and to flag up their concerns for fair trade and aid to Africa and writing off debt of the poorest nations. This was all happening in Edinburgh, this very small city of 400,000 people, in a single week, and I thought, what a great backdrop to a novel. So Rebus being a maverick, of course the police don't want him having anything to do with the G8, and so he's pushed to one side, but because he's pushed to one side, he's the only cop around when a murder does happen to take place. And so he's desperately running around in amongst all these riots and these famous people rubbing shoulders with them, trying to solve a murder. And it's shaping up pretty well. He even gets to meet George Bush.
How about that?
Yeah, and I think I've finessed it in such a way that it's actually realistic that it would have happened.
Oh, I can't wait to read that.
Yeah, you could say I've written this whole novel just to get that one scene in, actually.
Exactly, exactly. Well, Ian, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of what I know is a busy schedule for the listeners here in the States.
No problem, Casey. I've enjoyed it. Listen, man, the G8 book will be published in the States next spring, so you've not got that long to wait.
Okay, and maybe we'll have you on when Bleeding Hearts comes out, and we can talk a little bit about that and maybe get a little update on Rebus at the time, maybe this fall when that comes out.
Yeah, because by then this one will be finished, and I'll be on to the final book in the series, yeah.
Great, okay. Well, again, listeners, we've been discussing Blood Hunt today. Witch Hunt is also available in paperback. Flesh Market Alley is available in paperback. So you've got some good reading ahead of you. And Ian, I look forward to talking to you again this fall.
Yeah, appreciate it, Casey. Take care now.